Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has only two causes on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Lisa Casson, RN, Dallas County Hospital District, doing business as Parkland Memorial Hospital, Gurjeet S. Kalra, MD, and the University of Texas at Southwestern Medical Center at Dallas, versus Judy Hatley and William Johnson from Dallas County, and State Farm Life Insurance Company and Ted H. III versus Terry Beeston from Travis County. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioners may reserve a portion of their time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of these two causes. The arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience, and you may listen to a tape of the argument if you so desire by making application with the clerk of our court. Justice Enoch is recused in the first cause. Justice Gonzalez is not here but will participate in the deliberation and decision of both causes. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Casson versus Hatley.
May it please the court, Ms. Donna Iversano and Mr. James Ludlam represent argument for petitioner.
May it please the court. My name is Donna Aversano, and I represent Dr. Kalra and UT Southwestern Medical Center in this call today. The issue before us is, should a government physician and government medical center be held liable for a patient's decision to take her own life? I submit to you today that the doctrines of official and sovereign immunity, as well as the unpredictable nature of those with mental disorders, dictate that the answer to that question be no. The facts of this case are as follows. Penny Johnson came to Parkland Memorial Hospital emergency room on February 13, 1988, complaining of depression and exhibiting typical manipulative behavior, just as she had done 2 days earlier on February 11, 1988, and many other times as well. Dr. Kalra looked at the difficult patient file, which is in essence a treatment plan that has been developed by her health care providers. This treatment plan stated that hospitalization had been found not to be therapeutic for Ms. Johnson. The doctor should examine the patient and make a decision if there had been any changes in her behavior. If not, then she would not meet the criteria for admission. Dr. Kalra examined Ms. Johnson after made a decision that no change had been made in her behavior and decided that she was not eligible for admission into the Parkland emergency room. Somebody from the emergency room took away some medication that she had abused earlier that day and discharged her with an appointment scheduled with the forensic unit. A while later, Ms. Johnson ran out in front of a truck and was killed. The two issues that I wish to talk about today are official immunity for Dr. Kalra and the sovereign immunity of UT Southwestern Medical Center. And to begin with, I will talk about the official immunity that should be accorded to Dr. Kalra. I'd like to begin by making the statement that the current state of law of official immunity under the Armendariz case from the Fort Worth Court of Appeals should be reexamined. I would submit to the court that the official immunity test should be very simple and should be three parts as follows. First of all, number one, whether quasi-judicial activities, i.e. those requiring discretion, are undertaken, should be the first prong. Secondly, they should be in good faith. Thirdly, they should be in the course and scope of that party's employment. And if these three criteria are met, then as a matter of law, the governmental actor should be afforded official immunity. What the Armendariz case, however, has done, it has placed a uniquely governmental characterization to be considered. If the actor's actions are not uniquely governmental in nature, then the Armendariz case would have us not afford official immunity to such an actor. I would say that this distinction is unworkable. First of all, I would say that there are very few positions that are uniquely governmental in nature. And as this court has recently said, although in another context relating to sovereign immunity, in the Guillory versus Port of Houston case, Any comparison between the private and public sector is really unworkable. And in fact, what would happen would be that immunity would be abolished entirely. I realize that that isn't a sovereign immunity aspect, but I think it is analogous to the case at hand here because that's exactly what would happen. Likewise, I would also like to argue that even if, that his actions were discretionary in nature. I believe that's the whole focus of the case in front of us today. And I would like to compare it to a case that was heard by the Waco Court of Appeals, the Austin versus Hill case. There may be some contention by the respondent that Dr. Kalra's actions were not discretionary in nature because he looked at a difficult patient file. This, in essence, described what he should do. I would urge the court that Dr. Kalra's actions were, in fact, discretionary because he had to make a decision about whether this patient met the commitment or the admission criteria.
That becomes relevant, I guess, only if we reject the Armendariz test for official immunity.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, it would become relevant if you would look at the uniquely government.
In other words, if we apply the same test for official immunity to physicians employed by the government as we do to all other government employees who are sued for their torts, we would look to see whether it's a ministerial act versus discretionary and done in good faith and the course and scope of their duties rather than look to see whether it's apply the set out in Armendariz.
That's correct, Your Honor. You would not have to look to the uniquely governmental nature of their conduct. And right now I'm talking about the discretionary nature of his conduct, and I would like to urge that it is discretionary by analogy to the Austin versus Hale case, where a worker had to make a determination about whether a child was being subjected to child abuse. And there is it under the mental health code, there is a very strict procedure that is to be followed to make an investigation about allegations of child abuse. Now, while there are some components that are promulgated that use the word shall and dictate how an actor would go about conducting an investigation, a good bulk of this investigation involves the deliberation and thought-making processes of the individual making the investigation. They have to ultimately come to a decision whether child abuse was taking place. And in the Austin versus Hill case, they said, while portions of this actor's actions may be ministerial and that certain things are promulgated like that, if it is intermingled with discretionary actions, therefore the bulk of the actions of the actor are discretionary and official immunity should be accorded, even in such a case where ultimately the wrong decision was made. I would submit to you this is analogous to Dr. Kalra's actions with a difficult patient file, where there may be some actions that are talked about and dictate that he should proceed a certain way. The bulk of the actions undertaken by Dr. Kalra were discretionary in nature, and I would also like to point out a Michigan Supreme Court case which has touched on this very same topic in this very same setting on official immunity for a psychiatric defendant psychiatrist. This court has held, plenty of the activities of the defendant psychiatrist are anything but ministerial. The decisions required of these persons are perhaps the ultimate indiscretion. To determine the state of a person's psyche is in itself a task requiring great discretion. And when this task is conjoined with the even more imposing job of resolving another's liberty, the consequent decision cannot be said to be ministerial in any sense of the word. As I said earlier, I feel that the uniquely governmental distinction is unworkable, and as the court has articulated in the Guillory versus Port of Houston case, it is at least unworkable in the sovereign immunity context. And with that, I'd like to also move on to my sovereign immunity argument.
Let me ask you one more question. Counsel, in your brief, you talk about Parkland being very restricted in the number of beds it has, only 18 beds, et cetera. Is that in the record?
No, Your Honor, it's not. I would also like to move on to the sovereign immunity argument, and I would submit to you that UT Southwestern Medical Center would not have any liability in this case because there's a requirement under the Tort Claims Act that any personal injury must be caused by a use or condition of personable, tangible property. And in this case, I would submit to the court that such property, first of all, was not used. Secondly, what really was going on in this case was a lack of judgment or incorrect judgment, which is not actionable under the Tort Claims Act. And finally, that any alleged property that was at the scene would not be the proximate cause of Ms. Johnson's injuries. To begin with, I'd like to look at the property that was alleged by the respondent, and the pieces of property that have been alleged in their Fifth Amendment petition that were before the court were the medical records, a policies and procedures manual, and the difficult patient file itself. And I would tell the court that these pieces of property, so-called, that are alleged, are really information that has been transformed onto a paper and is analogous to the medical records that this court recently found in the York decision to not constitute property. So I would find that this is not property. It is really just intangible information that has been set upon into paper and that doesn't change the character of its essence, which is non-property. But if the court should hold that this is property, I would urge the court that there is no proximate cause. There is no causal connection between this so-called property and the injury that befell Ms. Johnson. I would tell the court that this property, there needs to be a close causal connection and a nexus of sorts between the property and the injury sustained. And I would point out to the court the Supreme Court's decision in Love, although involving a bus and a motor vehicle, the court stated that there must be a close causal connection between the property and the injury, i.e. a nexus of sorts. And in that case, a student came on a bus through the rear door, and while the bus was stopped, hit her head, causing injury to her head. And the court said that there is not a close enough causal connection in that case between the bus, the piece of property, and the injury that she suffered. It just happened to be the setting for her injury. It did not cause her injury as such. Secondly, there's another case that this court has looked upon, the Mount Pleasant case, also involving use of a motor vehicle and a bus, where a girl got out of a bus at a stop sign. The bus proceeded on 200 yards or longer, and then she crossed the street and was ultimately hit and killed. And the court has held that there was not a close enough causal connection between this bus and her injury. So I would urge the court that that there is no use of property, and that secondly, if the use of property should be found, that there was no proximate cause between this person's injury and the property that was used.
Any questions? Thank you,
Jim Ludlam for Nurse Lisa Case. I'd like first to address the question of whether or not the qualified immunity defense is available to the petitioner Lisa Case as a nurse employed in governmental service. We first looked at Section 101.026 of the Texas Tort Claims Act, and it essentially says that the immunity defense at common law is preserved. Then we look at Section 5.001 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and it says we follow the common law of England, except to the extent that the Texas legislature or the Texas Constitution provide otherwise. We can find no cases in English common law which say that the immunity defense does not apply to a medical provider in governmental service. Therefore, from that simple premise, we take the position that the immunity defense should be available. We adopt the arguments that have already been made here today, and I'd like to address the uniquely governmental test under the Armendariz case. If we apply that test, we wind up with a situation where a number of different classifications of state employees or political subdivision employees will not have the benefit of the immunity defense. We can look at secretaries, receptionists, janitors, clerks. And just to give a simple example, suppose that we have a situation where a receptionist in a state office building here is approached by a visitor who has business with the state, and believing that a certain department is in one building across the street, she sends the folks across the street. They're hit by a car and injured or killed crossing the street. This receptionist believed that she was sending them to the right place in good faith. Is she going to be stripped of her defense because a receptionist in private industry would be doing exactly the same function. The common law did not provide for a uniquely governmental test. Section signed 101.026 of the Texas Tort Claims Act does not create a uniquely governmental test. It provides for an immunity test for employees. And the test is those who make discretionary decisions, acting in good faith within the scope and course of their employment, are entitled to immunity from liability. Now we take a look at the facts of this case. What should be done with Nurse Lisa Kaysen's case now? At the end of the trial of this case, she moved for a trial amendment to include the immunity defense. And I might add that I just joined the defense of this case about 3 weeks before trial. She was granted that, and then she moved for a directed verdict on the basis of her qualified immunity defense. And she relied on her testimony that was given during the trial, her brief testimony that was given during the trial, which developed the good faith defense. And for the purpose of brevity, I'll refer the court to the transcript at pages 132 through 134 and page 143. And that contains those four pages contain the operative testimony. Essentially, what had happened is when Penny Johnson came in, her purse was taken from her. It was loaded with Dilantin. She had already indicated that she'd had quite a bit of that day. The record otherwise reflects that Dilantin is a medication that is not going to cause someone to overdose to the point of becoming comatose or causing death, but it will make you become groggy and it will slow you down. It's an anesthesia medication. She'd indicated when she came to the hospital seeking admission that she'd already had some that day. When she left, she wanted her purse and her medication back. Nurse Kaysen was faced with this situation. It was in Parkland Hospital. The area around there is fairly dangerous. She didn't want the girl going out alone because she was already drowsy. And so she made a judgment call. She thought, how do I get her out of here with her medication, let her keep her medicine like she wants to, but get her out of here safely? Well, what she did is she offered her a free taxi ride home from Parkland Hospital to her house with her medication. That involved a decision on her part. In fact, it was a decision which I believe meets the objective and subjective test suggested by Justice Cronin in his recent opinion of Travis versus Mesquite. Essentially, what she did is she was looking for a way to protect this lady, to get her home but with her medication. That involved a decision. In fact, I think it was a rather good decision and a rather creative decision. If we go back to the Jones versus Campbell test at 264 Southwest 2nd 425, I believe that's a 1954 Texas Supreme Court case where the test is suggested to be for good faith and absence of malice, certainly what Mrs. Kaysen did was not malice. It was calculated to protect the girl's interest. Now, there is some testimony in the trial record in this case from an expert for the plaintiffs which suggests that Nurse Kaysen was involved in a power play, to exercise power over this patient by holding her medicine back and then giving her to her on conditions specified by Nurse Kaysen herself. First of all, there's no evidence developed at trial from Nurse Kaysen to that effect, and secondly, the opinion given by that expert is pure speculation and is made without the benefit of the good faith defense testimony given by Nurse Kaysen at the trial, which is found at pages 132 and 134 of the transcript.
Are there any questions?
Yes.
Yes.
I'm interested in the procedures manual that co-counsel mentioned. Perhaps it would be better for her to respond to it when you're on rebuttal.
Probably would. But in any event, the judge...
Any other questions?
Sir.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
The court is now ready to hear argument from respondents.
Can I please the court, Mr. David Weiner, to present argument for
May it please the court. I'm David Weiner. Together with John Harani, who is sitting at council table, we represent the respondents in this case, Judith Hatton and William Johnson. I'll first address the question of whether the Dr. Kalra and Nurse Kaysen should be entitled to claim the protection of qualified immunity. Our position, of course, is that they are not, because their decisions in this case that were challenged by the plaintiffs and formed the basis of this lawsuit constitute medical treatment decisions. They do not involve governmental judgment, and therefore the underlying purpose for the qualified immunity doctrine does not apply, And therefore, we urge the court to adopt and, in effect, to ratify the reasoning in the Armendariz case, as well as the Court of Appeals in this case.
Are medical, government medical employees the only category of government employees to whom this Armendariz test would apply, that is, the dichotomy between governmental and occupational?
I don't think that that's necessarily true. Apparently, however, so far, that's the only category to which that has been addressed by the courts. Although, in the Priscilla's case, a number of years ago, the Court of Appeals in that case did appear without expressly saying so to apply the same type of test to the actions of a professor at Southwest Texas State in the way that he carried out the performance of a play.
Do you contest the argument of one of your opposing counsels that under the Armendariz test that secretaries, receptionists, clerks employed by government would not have the benefit of official immunity?
If there's no showing, if there's no evidence on the part of such an employee that anything that they were doing was different from what their counterparts in the private sector would be doing, or that anything that they were doing was uniquely governmental, then the answer is yes, we do contest it, and we contend that they should not be entitled to qualified immunity.
Would that be analogous to the proprietary governmental distinction made in sovereign immunity cases?
If
what is being done is, in essence, an act which could and is being performed by private individuals outside of government, and it doesn't qualify as a governmental act, and thus is not getting the benefit of sovereign immunity.
There's a slight analogy, and I think that there's a temptation to carry that analogy so far as to apply that same reasoning in this context. But I think there's a very compelling reason why it shouldn't be. In Guillory, the statement was made that there's almost nothing done by governmental units that could not also be done by private employers or private units. That statement, of course, was made in the context of determining the extent of the waiver of sovereign immunity under the Tort Claims Act. And as the court noted from the outset in that case, that is a matter that is addressed to the legislature. The court also made it pretty clear that, of course, we're coming from the historical background there, that historically, governmental units enjoy absolute sovereign immunity. The legislature came along with the Tort Claims Act and waived that immunity to a certain extent. And therefore, it is up to the legislature, as the court reiterated, to determine whether governmental units should be subject to liability and the extent of the waiver of their immunity. In contrast to that, historically, individual governmental employees have been subject to personal individual liability. And the doctrine of qualified immunity is a common law development that provides an affirmative defense for those employees. In a certain sense, the affirmative defense of qualified immunity is an exception to the general rule of individual personal liability. And therefore, in contrast to the question of the extent of the waiver of sovereign immunity, which is addressed to the legislature, it is up to this court to determine the limit of the affirmative defense of qualified immunity.
And sovereign immunity and official immunity are both common law doctrines, are they not?
Yes, but of course the
your distinction is that sovereign immunity has been around a lot longer.
Well, the distinction is that the legislature has stepped in to determine, well, that the starting point for the individual liability of the government employees is that they are subject to that liability, even if their employers were not, because of sovereign immunity. But sovereign immunity existed and the legislature came along and determined it should be waived, but only to a certain extent. And therefore, it remained for the legislature to determine the limit of that waiver. But this court came, or since the doctrine of qualified immunity was fashioned as an exception to the general rule of individual liability, it's up to this court to determine the limit of that affirmative defense, the limit of that exception, and this court should do so, keeping in mind the underlying purpose of qualified immunity, which is to protect certain governmental officials from the threat of a lawsuit in performance of their duty. Our position, just as the Armendariz court said, is that that policy, that purpose is not served by extending qualified immunity to doctors or to nurses who are employed by the government, because they face no greater threat of a lawsuit with respect to their treatment decisions than do their counterparts in the private sector. So it's very important to keep in mind that historical background and the difference that and the different result that should be reached as far as sovereign immunity with respect to the governmental units on the one hand and qualified official or quasi judicial immunity with respect to the individuals on the other hand. What we would suggest is what the Armendariz court did and said in that case, which is they were not changing the law or the Texas law as it pertains to qualified immunity, but rather they were clarifying the law. And that's what we believe that the court can and should do in this case. The court should clarify or refine the test that has traditionally been recited as to qualified immunity. Typically, it's said that government officials who, in the good faith performance of discretionary functions within the scope of their authority, are entitled to qualified immunity. We believe it's important for this court to take that test and clarify it and take it one step further and to state that it's not just the good faith performance of discretionary functions, but it's the good faith performance of discretionary functions of a governmental nature within the scope of the employee's authority that triggers or brings into play the doctrine of qualified immunity.
So we look at the character of the act as opposed to the entity on behalf of whom the act is performed?
Exactly.
Undeniably, it would be an act on behalf of the governmental entity. You're saying we need to look at the character.
Yes, we look at the character of the act. Of course it is. It's just, in a sense, it's just happenstance that happens to be on behalf of a governmental entity that employee is working for a governmental entity. But what is most important is the character, because the purpose of qualified immunity is to protect government employees from the risk of a lawsuit or the risk of liability for performing their job. But they should only be protected for official acts. In other words, those things which are different from acts in the private sector, those things which are unique.
Wouldn't there be an element here of governmental duty to treat a citizen at a Parkland is the governmental hospital. A physician in private practice perhaps would not have to treat someone who comes to their office.
Well, there's been some assertions by Dr. Kalra and Southwestern that Dr. Kalra had to make a determination in this case about whether facilities were available, whether Johnson was eligible for treatment. There's assertions about the limited availability of beds. But as Justice Phillips asked and as counsel stated, there's no evidence in this record as to any differences between what might happen at a hospital in the private sector and what did or might have happened in this case. It doesn't. Our allegations in this case and the proof that we have in this case do not relate admit a determination or decision to admit Ms. Johnson as
no, to... No, I'm the initial decision of treatment has an element of governmental duty.
Well, it could, but there's certainly no evidence in this case that the initial decision of treatment in this case was based upon some special consideration applicable in that setting, rather than making a medical judgment about whether Ms. Johnson should be admitted or she should be treated. And then the subsequent decisions, of course, which really form the basis for the claim, are questions of medical malpractice. They're simply questions of medical judgment, not of governmental judgment. If we turn to the question about whether the claims that we've alleged in this case meet the use of property requirement under the Tort Claims Act, we certainly believe that we sufficiently allege the cause of action under the Tort Claims Act, and we certainly believe, and which is really the only inquiry that the court needs to make with respect to UT Southwestern. UT Southwestern's motion for summary judgment was based strictly on a failure to state a cause of action in the Tort Claims Act. The Court of Appeals ended up analyzing the issue in terms of what the summary judgment evidence showed, but it is sufficient to look at the pleadings in this case, which was what were attacked in this motion for summary judgment, and to conclude that the plaintiffs sufficiently stated a cause of action under the Tort Claims Act. Additionally, the Court of Appeals was correct as far as its analysis of the summary judgment evidence in this case in concluding that there were fact questions as to the use of property sufficient to state a claim.
How is this case distinguishable from York?
York, of course, the court held that medical records cannot constitute tangible personal property under the Tort Claims Act. To the extent that York, and in light of York, it is probably somewhat doubtful that the claims in this case concerning the difficult patient file, the policy and procedures manual, and any other medical records.
Is policy and procedures manual a medical record?
Well, it's not a medical record, of course, but it is a piece of paper or a set of papers.
It's like a tool, isn't it?
It's a tool, and it is conceivably distinguishable from
like a mechanic's manual when he's repairing a vehicle or a piece of the shoe.
I will not dwell upon whether the policy and procedures manual and the difficult patient file and other papers could form the basis for the claims in this case. But rather, I want to focus on something that counsel for Dr. Collar and Southwestern have not even mentioned in their argument or in their application for writ of error, and that is our claims concerning the handling of Penny Johnson's medications. Now, even with York, which dealt with medical records, York did not disturb what this court had to say in Petty, as well as what this court had said earlier in the Salcedo decision concerning the proximate cause aspect of the personal property. The medications in this case, which it is shown were involved, that were taken from Penny Johnson, and that the personnel refused to return to her upon her leaving the hospital, were definitely personal property. I don't think there's any question that that personal property, the handling of that personal property, and the decision in the handling of that personal property constitute a use of that property. And furthermore, under Salcedo, as it was reiterated by the plurality of the court in Petty, which was an aspect that was not disturbed by the decision in York, there's no requirement of showing that the personal property itself was the proximate cause of the injury or the death, that the personal property was the actual instrumentality of the harm. The only requirement is to show, of course, that the negligent conduct that did cause the injury or the death involved the use of property. As long as Salcedo remains the law, as long as that aspect of the plurality decision in Petty remains good law, there is no requirement that the personal property itself was the proximate cause of the injury. We have, both with respect to the summary judgment that UT Southwestern obtained, we had allegations that it was the negligent use of Penny Johnson's medication in refusing to return it to her that proximately caused her death. We have summary judgment evidence from the expert that said it was the negligence of Dr. Cholera and Southwestern in the refusal to return that medication that was the proximate cause of Penny Johnson's death.
If they returned it and she had overdosed on Ritalin or Dilantin, I beg your pardon, they'd find themselves in the same posture they are today.
Well, of course, it's somewhat speculative what kind of claim could have been made, if any. What the claim was, and of course what the expert testimony was, is that it is absolutely a violation of the standard of care not to return a patient's medication to her when it's apparent that she's going to be discharged from the hospital. I can't predict what would happen or develop under another scenario, but under this record, there are allegations and there's proof that the negligence in the use of that property was the proximate cause of death. And likewise, with respect to Parkland Hospital, we had the testimony at trial through that same expert that it was the negligence of Parkland staff that proximately caused the negligence of Parkland staff in the use of that property in the handling of that medication that proximately caused Penny Johnson's death. Now, Parkland makes the argument that there's no evidence that any Parkland employees were involved in the taking of the medication from Penny Johnson. First thing I would have to say about that is that the Court of Appeals was correct as far as noting that the evidence on that question is certainly at least conflicting. So for directed verdict purposes, there was certainly enough evidence. But even more importantly, it's undisputed that Nurse Kasten, Nurse Knowles, who was not a party to the case, Nurse Kasten and Nurse Knowles, who were both Parkland employees, participated in the joint decision together with Dr. Cholera to keep Penny Johnson's medication when she left the hospital, even in the face of her threat to go out and kill herself by throwing herself in front of a truck. So there's certainly, and what our expert said at trial was it was that decision to keep the medication from her when she was discharged and when she made the threat that constituted the negligence that resulted in her death. So certainly all the requirements for a claim under the Tort Claims Act are met. Of course, the medication did not belong to the hospital, the physicians, or any of the staff, but that's never been required under the Tort Claims Act. If there are no remaining questions, that concludes my session.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Counsel, what is this procedures manual? What does it do?
The procedures manual?
Right.
It's just policies and procedures from the hospital.
Does it prescribe course of action or indicate optional courses of action when a patient comes in off the street? What does it do?
I think the more the document that would have more appropriate prescriptions as to this particular occasion.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I'm sorry. I think the document that it would have the most, more appropriate prescriptions as to this case would be the difficult patient file, which is more...
So the procedures manual relates to dealing with patients generally.
Generally.
The operation of the emergency room at the hospital generally,
right.
I would say. The difficult patient file pertains to a particular patient, doesn't it?
It does.
It's part of that person's medical records.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The procedures manual sets out a standard performance, doesn't it?
It sets out standard operating procedures for the hospital.
Standard operating procedures. How would it relate to this case?
Your Honor, I would submit that it does not. I would submit that it's just an incidental piece of property that has been named by the respondent.
It doesn't prescribe how to deal with patients when they come into emergency, or they're brought in this case by a law enforcement officer?
It has some prescriptions as to how to deal with certain things in the hospital setting, but it does not have anything to do with mandating how this particular patient should be handled.
Doesn't have any even broad guidelines in it?
It has some, and it may have some broad guidelines, but I would say that it is not, it would not be, as I stated earlier, would not be the proximate cause of any injury to this particular party.
Well, I don't know, would or not. The mechanic has a procedures manual and repair a particular piece of machinery. It doesn't follow it. You might say that that negligence and the failure to use that piece of property had some causal relationship, at least, to the improper work that was done on the piece of machinery. It's possible, I would think, that in this setting, if there's a procedures manual and it wasn't referred to and wasn't relied upon, it wasn't followed as far as standards are concerned, that it might have made some contribution to the death of this person.
I would urge, Your Honor, that there's been no showing by the respondents that in any way that this policy of procedures manual has not been relied on incorrectly. I think the sum and total of their allegations seem to stem around the difficult patient file with dictating singular treatment for this patient. The policy and procedure manual has not contained anything that this doctor did not follow and really did not have anything specifically to do with this patient.
Why is it in here? Why was it relied upon?
I think it was urged by the respondents simply to name a piece of property to bring this case within the purview of the Texas Tort Claims Act. But as I have urged earlier under York, I believe that is not a piece of property.
How about the allegation that the medicine
was
in her possession and was taken away and not returned is the use of property?
I would urge, Your Honor, that the allegations of a drug or the medicine is not properly before this court. In plaintiff's Fifth Amendment petition, which is the petition that was attacked under our motion for summary judgment, the pieces of property that are alleged in the Fifth Amendment petition are namely the policy and procedure manual, the difficult patient file, and the medical records. And the language says the property is as follows. I'm not reading verbatim, but that's what it says. There's a allegation of failure to return person property, but there is no specific linkage of any drug and property, and when specifically called upon to name the property, the drug is missing from the plaintiff's petition, and I would urge is not properly before the court. But even as such, if the court would construe the drug as being property under the Tort Claims Act and would find it properly before the court, then I would urge, as I said earlier, under the Lalo and Mount Pleasant cases, that there is no proximate cause between this drug, which this patient did abuse and threatened to continue to abuse, and her ultimate fate in this case. If I may, Your Honor, I'd like to address just a few points on the official immunity argument. I think a case that may be instructive here that has some definitions about governmental judgment, which, as I would like to remind the court, I do not believe the uniquely governmental distinction is a workable one and would abolish official immunity as it stands. But if we are going to look to that definition, I think one case that would provide some judgment would be the Cleason case. And that case simply says that if a doctor is determining whether a patient is eligible for treatment, that would be governmental judgment. And I would urge the court that is precisely what is being done in this case by Dr. Caldwell.
Any other questions?
Yes, counsel. As a representative of the Attorney General's office, can you
tell us whether governmental employees who are performing non-uniquely governmental functions are provided with liability insurance by the state against suits for their, against them individually?
No, Your Honor, we are not provided with liability insurance per se. We are indemnified by the state for up to $100,000 should we be sued, but we have no liability insurance as an equivalent in the private sector would have.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank
that
you.
Concludes the argument in the first cause, and the court will now take a brief recess.
Can I please rise?